from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today we'll visit a self-defense class geared towards queer and transgender people. Then we'll meet a local educator using virtual story time to get kids interested in reading.
I always tell parents when I tell them about it, if you don't feel like reading to your kids, I'll do it for you. So that bedtime story, sure, I'll read. And that afternoon read aloud, let me do it with them.
Plus, our Live at Lake Effect music series goes country with musician and actress Lola Kirk.
There's something really fun about playing like a Jewish cowgirl, which is the half-Jewish cowgirl, which is kind of what I'm doing now in my role as country singer.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thank you so much for joining us. Over the past few years, there's been a significant jump in hate crimes. That includes those against the LGBTQ community, which accounts for nearly 1 in 5 crimes. To counter those stats and to make community members feel safer, last week a gym in Milwaukee hosted a self-defense workshop. WUWM's Jimmy Gutierrez was there and brought back this story.
Last week, the Westside Gym Fit Power hosted a self-defense class, but it wasn't your ordinary class.
And we wanted to do it in a way that wasn't fear-based, also in a way that worked with the communities that matter to us most.
This is Jessica Sunnier. She owns the gym. The community she's talking about, the community this class is for, are queer and trans people.
With the political climate as it is and, you know, having actually been threatened by people in public before, I just want to be prepared, unfortunately, you know, to defend myself and, you know, defend my community if I have to.
The reason why I came here today is just with the culture going on right now, I wanted to find a way to keep myself safe and also protect my comrades as well, especially being in the media with the violence towards media right now.
This is Maddie O'Connell and Nyresha Williams. Nyresha says she's been assaulted before, so have her friends. So this isn't a hypothetical for her. Maddie's been bullied and says she's been pushed around while documenting protests. Tonight's class has about 20 people in it, mostly from Sunseeker MKE and Trans Liberation MKE.
Once everyone is back on the mats, you are going to find a partner, and you and your partner are going to be on opposite sides of the mats. We'll have one person down here.
Participants are told to partner off. They sit 10 feet across from each other on the gym's jujitsu mats. They find out that they're about to start walking like a crab.
Only stipulations with this, your belly has to be facing the ceiling the whole time. So you cannot roll over, you can't flip to the mat, but you can use all four limbs, you can use your butt, you can use your elbows, whatever you need to get to the other side.
Okay. This is Oswin Tyron. They're a coach at the gym. And they're leading tonight's class.
Shrimp. So it's a really fundamental movement that we learn in a lot of self-defense and especially jujitsu practices, where it's essentially learning how to move without use of your limbs or being able to rotate your body without having to go your belly to the ground.
Oswin makes the crab walk more challenging.
All right, next round, we are now just going to take away a limb. So it can be a hand, can be a foot.
Now they'll walk down the mat, taking away one arm or leg. And the choices people made were very creative. Maybe not effective, but creative.
We're once again taking away one more limb. So you should be down to just one now, okay?
The goal here is to practice framing. That's where in jiu-jitsu, someone's on their back and they use their arms and legs to create space from an opponent. Maddie picks it right up.
How's that feel?
Yeah, feels good.
Is it unnatural or is it like...
No, it's really not, actually. Yeah. Even when my friends would accidentally land on me in roller derby. And we'd be like, whose leg is that?
Now, Risha's getting there, too.
That was a good one.
Was it?
That was a good
one. Okay, good. Yeah. Thank you.
How's it coming along?
We're doing good so far. You know, it looks easier when the MMA fighters are doing it on TV. But
it does.
We're doing okay so far, I think.
You feel more dangerous already?
No, not quite yet. Maybe in a few more minutes. I feel activated. Maybe not dangerous, but activated.
Oswin brings the group back together. It's time for the next skill. Something that can terrify every type of person. Conversations.
What are your pronouns?
She, her.
She, her.
Yeah.
Mine are she, they.
primarily. We're trying to mimic essentially being in a larger crowded area, so protest, club, whatever. But what we're going to ask them after this is essentially if they noticed anything happening in the room. So like what Jess is about to do is ask how many exits are in the gym, how many people are in the gym, did you notice them doing anything? So essentially being aware of your surroundings while you are...
Like how one of the coaches was kicking a medicine ball around the gym the entire time. By the way, it seems like every group clocked that. At this point, the class is warmed up. The earlier nervous energy is now just energy waiting to be directed.
But we're going to move on to grip work. And so when somebody grabs your wrist, we're going to teach it in a few ways. You know, there's one way.
If this were a movie, this would be our training montage scene. But since it's radio, well, let's cue the montage music. First comes simple wrist breaks, or breaking away from someone who grabs your wrists. It levels up from there. Think big motions.
Can I just say something before you do this?
Yeah.
The way that your eyes lit up when the chop came in.
Yeah.
I can't really say what I want to say because it glorifies the wrong things, but a certain type of slap is what I got reminded of. Grab you like that.
No, they make it look so clean. I'm like...
It's like arm wrestling in a really weird way.
That was.
It's getting dangerous. It's getting dangerous. Okay, hold on. Wait. Let's. Now you gotta.
I have dyscalculia, so like, okay. I mix up my right and left. Probably will be the death of me.
Sometimes, as a reporter, when you're on the battlefield, you get hit with live rounds. That was my microphone on the receiving end of a chop. Jessica Sunnier checks in with some of the groups, corrects techniques, shares some encouraging words. She says starting this gym 15 years ago kind of happened by accident. Gym culture and jiu-jitsu gyms can be toxic places, very unsafe places for women, queer, trans people.
There's a really big need for specifically marginalized groups to feel like they can play. Like, this is play. They're learning and they're playing and they're laughing and they're learning such a valuable technique without it being fear-based, because it's very vulnerable. Like, being in your body can be a very vulnerable experience for some people. So we're just, man, I don't know. It feels great though, doesn't it? This was the happiest intentional accident that ever happened, I guess. Yeah, I could not have wanted more for the gym, so.
Meanwhile, back to our montage.
Try it tighter, yeah?
Yep.
All right. Damn, that actually worked.
I know, it's the physics of it is like crazy.
Okay. All right, where are we at in our danger level?
We're getting close to red, threat level.
Like, for sure.
Threat level midnight. We're getting up there, for sure.
I'm getting afraid.
You're seeing different things?
You're scared on the sidelines.
I'm scared of being in the room.
The class is buzzing at this point. When I ask people how they're feeling, they say things like empowered, active, dangerous, and some other words not fit for radio. After 2 hours, things wrap up. People slowly start to make their way out of the gym. They're walking a little more upright. I could be projecting, but it looks like the workshop was a success. That's what Maddie and Narisha tell me.
I felt like watching everybody like try the different stuff was cool. You could see people get more comfortable with it, which was awesome. And I met new people and, you know, talked to new people, met new names, saw new faces. So, yeah, I think it was a success.
Do you feel more dangerous?
I feel absolutely lethal.
I learned a lot of really good stuff, and I also got a little bit of first aid training, which is also a goal that I wanted to get. And I feel like I'm more prepared to kind of look out for my colleagues and stuff out in the field, especially because journalism is it's kind of a dangerous field right now with the current climate, and I feel more prepared to help my friends and also defend myself as well.
Osmond is the last person in the gym. I tell them what Nairisha and Maddie said. It's exactly what Osmond was hoping people would get from the class.
Just hope, wanting people to have some awareness of, A, whenever they walk into a building, being able to recognize their surroundings, know where exits are, have some awareness of the people that are in there, and B, come away with a little bit of self-defense knowledge so that they feel a little bit more confident, just in case they ever are in a situation where they're grabbed, not feeling safe. At least they have a little bit of something to fall back on where they can reliably get away from that situation if need be.
Why offer the event to trans and queer folks at a time like this?
A lot of different reasons. There's a lot going on in the world right now. There's a lot of specifically trans and queer people that are feeling a little uneasy about especially things in the U.S. right now. So we're hoping to just provide a little bit more comfort to the community, create even more community by welcoming them and other movements into our space to be able to provide them with these free resources and education for them.
I'm told this isn't the last workshop the gym will host. In a few months, I'll be teaching even more moves and techniques. Threat Level Midnight.
That story was reported by WUWM's Jimmy Gutierrez. To find out more information about the self-defense workshops, you can get in touch with Fit Power Gym, Trans Liberation MKE, or Sunseeker MKE. In about 10 minutes, we'll explore the life and legacy of politician and civil rights activist Val Phillips. But first, we'll tell you about Just Us and Books, a way for kids to engage with books and storytelling online. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Virtual learning and educating has been a hard adjustment for many teachers. During the pandemic, things that were once cornerstones of lessons had to evolve for new platforms. But for educator Danette Justice, the switch to virtual learning also opened a new opportunity. Justice is an educator with Milwaukee Public Schools and the creator of Just Us and Books. It's a program where she introduces kids to new books and the power of reading through both virtual and in-person story times. Justice joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about the program and how it started.
Just Us and Books started during COVID. On the first day of school, it is virtual learning, and so had to figure out a way to reach all the students and made a recording of me reading a book, uploaded it to the teacher's Google Classroom, where, of course, students and teachers had access and thought that would be it. And a teacher asked me, what was I going to be reading next? And I said, oh, okay. And then a student commented, put a little comment under there and said, oh, you're a good reader. And I said, oh, thank you. And so I read another book the next week and it continued. And finally, I had a little group of readings and I was also uploading them to Facebook. And so parents could use them as they needed to with their kids at home. And a friend of mine, Dr. Latish Reed, said, you should put these on YouTube. Create a page. And I'm like, huh? And one thing led to another, and Just Us and Books was born. So, yeah.
Now, what is the focus of Just Us and Books? Because there's so many children's books out there. I'm sure that can get really overwhelming. Do you feel like you tend toward a specific kind of children's book?
I love fun books. I love when the pictures catch my eye. And honestly, the purpose is to have our students fall in love with reading, have children fall in love with reading. A lot of our kids don't necessarily like to pick up a book, and so I'm trying to make reading fun for them. And I always tell parents when I tell them about it, if you don't feel like reading to your kids, I'll do it for you. So that bedtime story, sure, I'll read. And that afternoon read aloud, let me do it with them. And a lot of them have activities. And then some of them actually connect to a business or a local landmark. So they're kind of getting a reading, an assignment, and a virtual field trip all in a story.
Very nice. What's an example of a children's book that is more local, that focuses on some local landmarks that kids have really taken to, that they've really enjoyed engaging with?
I did a book at Palermo's Pizza here in Milwaukee. Yeah. The actual title just escaped me, but it's about pizza making. And so, of course, I definitely try to tie in the book to where I'm going. And then once I read the story, we actually got to film making a pizza. And so the kids got to actually experience the whole process of making the pizza. They got to see a little bit of about how Palermo's does their operation. And so it was just a win-win. Another one that I love, Arnie the Donut. Now, if you've ever been to Cranky Al's here in actually Wauwatosa, best crawlers in the world. But I read the story. It's called Arnie the Donut. And then he showed us how to make donuts and that whole process. So kids absolutely love that one because I always show that one and then I always bring donuts. So they get to get to have an experience with the donuts. So, yeah.
Do you feel like those kinds of activities give kids kind of an in to reading? As you said, it can be difficult, I think, especially with so many screens in all of our lives,
yes,
to sit down and read a book, regardless of your age, mm-hmm, but especially for kids.
The hope is that because, yes, I know that our kids are on their tablets, they're on their phones, they're on their parents' phones. And the hope was that in between whatever you're doing, you'll watch a good story and maybe you'll say, Mom, let's go to the library, or Mom, let's go to the bookstore. I love this book. Let's go find this author. Or Mom, that was a great book. Let's go find that actual book. So the hope is that they'll be able to have that love and actually want to get more books. So I'm watching Just Us in Books and I enjoyed that book. Let's check out that author. Let's check out some more books similar to that one. That's the hope. That's the hope.
Now, when you're thinking about books for young readers, what are some of your favorite books to recommend to kids?
I always recommend to students the book that I fell in love with in third grade. It was called Where the Sidewalk Ends by Shel Silverstein. That was the book that made me fall in love with reading. So I share that book with all students. It's on Just Us in Books. Sarah Cynthia Sylvia Stout would not take the garbage out, and we talk about chores and helping out at home and what would happen if you didn't do your chores. So that is definitely a favorite of students. I have a lot of classics on Just Us in Books, and then I have a lot of work in a district with a large African-American population, and so I try to pick books with authors that are African-American and with characters that look just like them. But definitely there is a mix of books on Just Us in Books.
Very nice. Now, you have a book here with you.
Mm-hmm.
Can we hear a little bit of it?
Wow, yes, you absolutely. It is actually called All I Need to Be, and it is by Rachel Ricketts. She was actually nominated for an NAACP award for this particular book, so I am honored to read this. It's actually the first time I'm reading this book, so. As the sun rises and touches your face, you smile as you think today will be great. But there may be things that are not so great, some things that shake you and awaken self-hate. When today is too much and the world gets within, when you feel afraid like you just don't fit in, when you start to lose hold of all that you can be, hold on to what matters, to joy and being free. Take one deep breath and focus on your left. Hold your breath tight and focus on your right. Release your breath slow, then let your limbs go. When you're in touch with your body, you'll feel peace you can know. And the title of that book was All I Need to Be.
Very nice. Well, Danette, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Danette Justice is the creator of Just Us and Books, and she's been an educator with Milwaukee Public Schools for more than 3 decades. Justice spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. Milwaukee politician Vel Phillips died in 2018 at the age of 94. In 2025, it can be hard to appreciate the dedication and tenacity that it took for Phillips to succeed after she started her political career in 1956 at the age of 32. But here's a reminder of all the firsts that she accomplished. Vel Phillips was the first Black person and first woman to serve on the Milwaukee Common Council, the first Black elected statewide office holder in Wisconsin, and the first Black person elected to the Democratic Party's National Committee. Writer Barbara Miner dove into Phillips' history and the impact that she had, and she joins me to share more about it. We're talking about a very important woman today, Vel Phillips. And obviously a lot of people, especially locally, are familiar with Vel's accomplishments in her political career. But can you share more about her early years and her background?
very complicated. And Val is a complicated person. I mean, her very early background, she was born in Milwaukee, raised here in Milwaukee. But her parents were part of what was then sort of the established African-American community. Her father was a small businessman, restaurant, garage owner. So Val grew up in relative, and I say that very loosely, relative comfort. And in fact, she talks about in her very early years when she went door to door with the League of Women Voters and was just horrified at some of the conditions. And she said it broke her heart. And of those early years, her mother was clearly her strongest influence. And one of the things that is so associated with Val is something her mother always said, which was dream big. And Val took that and other lessons from her mother, but took that to heart.
Val has a ton of accomplishments. You know, we can't list and talk about all of them in our conversation today, but her political career started, you know, officially, shall we say, when she was 32 years old, she became the first woman and the first Black person on the Milwaukee Common Council. So can you share more context about the atmosphere and culture she was working in 1956?
Yes, the 1950s on some levels could as well be the 18th century in terms of how different it is from today. And I grew up in the 50s, you know, younger, but it's hard, I think, sometimes to appreciate what that culture was like for women and for Black people, but particularly women. I mean, for instance, there was not the approval of oral contraceptives until the 1960s, I think. Betty Friedan's The Feminist Mystique was not until the 1960s. And interestingly, it wasn't until 1974, we're talking 22 years after Val was first elected, that women could have their own bank account or credit card. And so the 50s were a complicated decade, coming off of World War II, economic prosperity in many ways. But the life for a lot of women and people of color was very different. And after the war, women were expected to go home and make babies.
And, you know, you touched upon some of the atmosphere for women and then for Black people. And Val obviously has a lot of compounded discrimination that she had experienced long before, you know, intersectionality had been a common word, right?
Exactly.
Can you share a little more about that? Because you had a conversation with her about what stood out to her the most about that.
Well, interestingly, I did a feature on Val in 2005. Hard to believe that's what, almost 20 years ago. And I had the good fortune to really, I drove her around, we had interviews, we spent some time together. And I would go to events where she would be, like community brainstorming, where she would be moderating. And we'd have lunch and, you know, conversations. And at one point, I asked her, because she was known as the first woman, the first African-American, I said, well, what was the hardest breakthrough? And initially, she just kind of, you know, thought about it and just said, you know, it was difficult, so to speak. And then a week or two later at the community brainstorming, she comes back to me. She says, you know, I've been thinking about that, and I really want to clarify. And then she talked about Shirley Chisholm, who is a African-American woman legislator from New York who also ran for president in the 60s. And she was friends with Val. I mean, there weren't that many women African-American politicians, and so they all knew each other. And Val said, you know, Shirley and I talked about this, and you're Black. Of course you're Black. And people know you're Black, and they don't forget that. But you're also a woman. But usually, once I was in a position, they kind of forgot that I was a Black woman. She said, but they never, ever, ever forgot I was a woman.
So powerful, right? Like, and sad that that's the takeaway.
Yes. Although, interestingly, I mean, misogyny was ever present from the moment she stepped foot into the Common Council chambers. A lot of stories there. But it was really the issue of her being an African-American politician. That was the issue that really led to sort of concerns about her personal safety and the safety of her children. So while one was ever present and aggravating, it did not rise to the level of physically threatening her. And that wasn't true around the open housing marches.
Right. Let's talk about the marches. Obviously, it's one of her key legacies is the open housing legislation. And I feel like most people know the marches and have a certain snapshot in their head, especially if they weren't alive during that time. Like we see the same kind of handful of photographs, right? But Vell was trying to act on this long before the marching tactic became enacted, right?
Oh, she was the first person to introduce the open housing legislation. And it was in 1962. We're talking, you know, 5 years before the open housing marches. In 1962, she first introduced open housing legislation, which would prohibit discrimination against African Americans in terms of renting and buying homes, which is very common at the time, open discrimination. And I believe it was like 15 to 1. She was the only person who voted in favor of it. And there were times, there were years where it wasn't even discussed. She would bring up the resolution, no discussion, there'd be a vote. She would be the only person in support of the legislation.
And then eventually down the road in 67, she throws herself behind the tactic championed by Father James Grappi here and the local NAACP Youth Council, which was the public demonstrations. And I feel like this is lost in some of the snapshots, how extensive it was, how dramatic.
Well, in the mid-60s is when just everything exploded. And 1967 nationally was sort of this national unrest. There were, you know, uprisings in Newark, Detroit. They called the troops into Detroit, Lyndon B. Johnson. And Father Grappi, shortly before that, had started the demonstrations for open housing. Grappi and the Youth Council were sort of an in the streets. Val was here working with the politicians on the legislation. And Grappi, they came to Val and said, listen, we want to take this up as an issue. They'd been doing other issues around school desegregation, the Eagles Club and their discriminatory practices. And they said, Val, we want to take this up. And Val said, go right ahead. She wasn't always out there in the demonstrations because she was acutely aware of the different roles at times. But it was in 67 when things just went kind of crazy. I mean, I don't quite know how to describe it, but that was when, in line with all the different uprisings in Newark, Detroit, Milwaukee had its own.
As we know Vell, we obviously identify her with Milwaukee, with Wisconsin, but her impact on the national stage is also really good, too. And you go into her roles in the DNC both in 1958 and the 1960 conventions. Can you explain kind of how Vell set herself apart on the national scale here?
Well, it's fascinating. And again, a lot of it had to do with open housing. That's always been both locally and nationally her political marker, her main issue. But in 58, she was elected to the Democratic National Committee, first African-American woman. And then 2 years later, at the convention when Kennedy was nominated. So not surprisingly, there was lots of discussion and floor fights over the platform. And there was a push for a strong civil rights platform as part of the Democratic Party platform. And you had your Southern Dems, the sort of segregationists, who said, oh, no, we can't adopt this civil rights platform. You're going to lose the South. This is government-enforced social equality. And they were adamantly opposed. And Val was on the committee, and one of the lessons here is don't ever get into a political fight with Val. She was so, so smart, and she always had a good response. So she says to the senator, well, how can you expect the world to, you know, respect us if we don't even enforce equality here at home? But then more importantly, she said something that I think actually remains one of Val's enduring markers of her beliefs. And she said, listen, it's more important to do the right thing. Luckily, the civil rights platform carried the day, and Kennedy won the election because the Southern segregationists, they said, oh, no, you're going to lose the election if you adopt this. But they didn't.
You're listening to Like Effect on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski speaking with Barbara Miner about her Milwaukee Magazine article on Vell Phillips. So, Barbara, you mentioned that Vell always thought it's more important to do the right thing. And I think it's kind of a through line for Vell in that throughout her whole career and all the challenges she faced, like there's the resilience, there's the tenacity, there's the quiet leadership by example. And she was many things, obviously, including proud, but she kept her personal life quite private, right?
Yes. Understandably, as a politician and as a woman. But one of the things that I think it's really important to get into about Val, in terms of her do the right thing, you know, to her dying day, she supported marriage equality. She supported a woman's right to choose. She supported LGBTQ. She supported, you know, school desegregation. She strongly supported public schools and opposed the voucher program. You know, you name an issue. She was a Bernie Sanders big supporter. You name an issue, and she came down on what, in hindsight, almost everyone recognizes was the right thing.
We, of course, have been talking about her local impact here in Milwaukee and Wisconsin. There's a statue at the state capitol and the Vell R. Phillips Plaza here in Milwaukee. So how are these public and accessible spaces designed to reflect her?
It is important, I think, that she's finally getting her due. And there's a lot of reasons behind that. And one of the things I discovered in this article and over time was how well she was known at the statewide level. I mean, I know her here in Milwaukee, but a dorm was named after her in Madison. The James Madison High School is now the Vell Phillips Memorial High School. She's well known around the state and in Madison. But also there's an interesting story of what happened in Madison, because it was the George Floyd protests. I mean, you know, COVID, George Floyd, that was a difficult time on many, many levels. And during one of the protests in Madison, and this had been true across the country of different statues and monuments being torn down. In the South, this was primarily Confederate segregationists. Well, in Madison, they tore down two statues. One was Lady Forward, who represents the state, you know, motto, and the other was a Norwegian-American who was an abolitionist. But interestingly, Michael Johnson, who's head of the Dane County Boys and Girls Club, he decided to go talk to the protesters. And that was a very smart move, rather than just assuming they did what they did, why they did. He said, I'm going to talk to them. And he found that, you know, beneath the rage, beneath the anger, beneath the confusion, they had a really, really valid point that there were absolutely no statues of people of color at the Capitol. And so Michael said, you know, this is right. We should do something about it. So that began the campaign around the statue of Vell Phillips at the state capitol. And here in Milwaukee, you know, Mileli Coggs, the alderperson, has a lot to do with really making sure that Vell got her due. There was the renaming of 4th Street to the Vell R. Phillips Drive. And then there was this pretty dingy corner there at 4th and Wisconsin, and it was city-owned. It's like, oh, what are we going to do with this? And ultimately, someone had the good sense to say, well, yeah, let's do a plaza and let's name it after Vell.
What sticks out the most to you about Vell? Are there any insights you want to share or details or stories that didn't make it into the article?
Well, this is a personal story because it involves my mother. And Vell was very close to her mother. And I had my differences with my mother, but by the end, we were quite close. And it also underscored to me that Vell was a people person. So I remember once I wanted to interview her, but we couldn't find a quiet restaurant. Everything was, it was downtown. It was noisy. And I said, you know, Vell, my mom lives at the Astor Hotel, and they have a quiet little coffee shop. And she goes, oh, your mom lives at the Astor? I've always wanted to see one of those apartments. Can I go see your apartment? I said, well, so I call my mom, and my mom's going like, Vell Phillips, my friend. She said, well, yeah, come on up. My mom was nervous because Val's pretty famous. And
yeah,
so they come
let me
up.
Clean first, right?
Yeah. Well, my mom kept it pretty clean. Yeah. House, so I knew my mom was a little nervous, and I'm going, well, it's an ask, Mom. But so we go up there, and there's a little bit of hi, you know, Barbara's mother, hi, Vell Phillips. Within about 2 minutes, these two older women are talking about their favorite solitaire card game. I just couldn't believe it. I mean, I don't know, you know, if Vell suddenly saw the card table with the cards, but all of a sudden they were like best buddies.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah. Well, Barbara, thank you so much for joining me today to share more about your piece on Vell Phillips. And we could talk about her for much longer, but
yes.
Thanks for what we talked about today.
Oh, no, thank you. And it's a homage to Vell. Thank you for letting more about her get out.
Barbara Miner is a writer and photographer here in Milwaukee. We spoke last year. We'll take one more break and then return with some music and a chat with Lola Kirk in our music series, Live at Lake Effect. Keep listening to Lake Effect on WUWM. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Live at Lake Effect is our music series featuring local and nationally touring artists performing at the Lake Effect Surf Shop in Shorewood, Wisconsin. We brought the Lake Effects together, along with Visionary Studios, to showcase musicians once a month through an interview with the band exclusively on Lake Effect, plus film performances. Today, we have Lola Kirk hailing from Nashville, Tennessee, to bring some original country tunes to the Surf Shop. You may already be familiar with Kirk as an actress. She's played many roles in film and TV, including Mozart in the Jungle, Gone Girl, and most recently as Joan in Ryan Coogler's vampire film of the summer, Sinners. Kirk made her Grand Ole Opry debut in February of last year, and her latest album, Trailblazer, is out now. Here's Kirk performing in the Lake Effect Surf Shop, accompanied by Josh Kaler on the electric guitar.
Hello, my name is Lola Kirk, and this is a song about the perils of cohabitation. It is called My House.
Woke up late, hungover again. Hot damn, it ain't even the weekend. Step into the kitchen, over a friend. I try to keep quiet so she can sleep in. I used to feel so alone in our king bed. I'm done crying over you, I'm better off instead. Come on to my house, it's on my nail, and I can do whatever I wanna. Call up the strippers, take them to dinner, and sing out loud till the morning. Shed a couple tears, choke on a thousand beers, 'cause this is my house since I kicked you out. And I can do whatever I wanna. Maybe you can come home in 28 days, 'cause we got a lot of love and a lot of bills to pay. But now I laugh all night, it's 5 o'clock all day. I kinda like this life, I'm the same, 'cause I never have to worry about if you'll come home. I'm done crying over you, I'm better off alone. Come on to my house, it's on my nail, and I can do whatever I wanna. Call up the strippers, take them to dinner, and sing out loud till the morning. Shed a couple tears, choke on a thousand beers, 'cause this is my house since I kicked you out.
Hi, this is Audrey Nowakowski from Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. We're here at the Lake Effect Surf Shop in Shorewood, along with Milwaukee musician Trapper Shep, who's also my fellow Live at Lake Effect co-producer. Hey, Trapper.
Yes, I am, Audrey. We have a terrific singer-songwriter here all the way from Nashville, Tennessee, Milwaukee. Here I come from Nashville, Tennessee. Sort
absolutely.
Of deal. Classic country. I haven't seen Lola Kirk since probably like 2011. Both our bands were playing near Bard College,
yes.
I believe, in upstate New York, or perhaps it was Hudson, New York. And as it happens, I lost track of you. And then in 2014, I was watching a movie called Gone Girl. I saw someone that looked a lot like you. And then 2 years later, I was watching a movie called,
Mistress America
with Greta Gerwig. So I love her and her filmmaking. And I was like, oh, that's definitely her. And then I went back and saw Gone Girl. And I was like, oh, Lola's an actress now. And I knew you as a terrific musician.
Oh, I'm so honored.
Yeah, leads me to my first question. Music or acting first, and how does each one feed into each other?
Well, I began my career as an actress, and I always thought that's what I would do more of. Music was always just such a passion and a hobby. I love listening to music, and I always have. But I do find it very empowering to get to write my own roles as a musician, so to speak. Like, I feel like I got cast a lot as like assistants and like girls in glasses, which I don't wear glasses, and I love playing women who wear glasses because, you know, there's a lot there. But I do think that there's something really fun about playing like a Jewish cowgirl, which is the half Jewish cowgirl, which is kind of what I'm doing now in my role as country singer.
What was the role in Gone Girl again? What were you?
Oh, she
like
didn't wear glasses. She just had herpes. She had a cold sore on her lip.
Sketchy character. Correct?
Yeah, okay. Those are like the two ends of the spectrum.
Totally.
Like assistant in glasses and like girl who will beat you up.
You can see why I like didn't completely put it together that was you, because it was like Lola Kirk, but like rough around the edges. Not that you didn't look, you know.
No. I think somewhere in between those two women is the true me, and that is what I'm expressing through my music.
Totally. Well, thank you for being here in this surf shop.
Oh,
this is
thank
just
you.
So random, but feels great.
I love it. I love singing to all of this surf gear.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Especially the LA tune, because it's like we're surfing, but we're also country.
But I feel like when you live in LA, unless you live like by the beach,
I
never even saw the beach when I lived there. Mm.
Too busy.
So far. No, it's just like miles away.
That's true. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's an endeavor.
It is an endeavor.
So you touched upon it a little bit, and I imagine when you're acting, obviously there's a lot of other people and factors into play. There's a whole crew. There's a director you're deferring to.
You have to get a job.
You have to get a job to begin with. And when you're playing and writing your songs, you're taking more of that leadership role. So can you touch a bit more upon how, not necessarily that you get into the character of a Jewish cowgirl, but, you know, when do you feel that need to switch over to the country singing? And, you know, which one, like, do you bother balancing them out, or do you at this point know what your preference is and what you want to spend your creative time towards?
I mean, I think I was always doing music like 30% and I was acting a lot more. I mean, it's a much more lucrative career if you can, it's nice work if you can get it being an actress, but, and music, I don't think you make money. I think someone might, but not me. Yeah. But I don't know. I think that to really make it work, I've had to put a lot more of my time into it, and I'm having a great time.
And you've had family members that have made it work. So it's perhaps, you know, to you, living the life of an artist is a bit more, you know, realistic than if you were to become a banker, perhaps.
Yeah,
or
I don't
something
think
like,
that. I think my family would have disowned me if I had gotten a real job.
And your dad played drums in Bad Company, correct?
Yes, and
no
Free.
Big deal.
No big deal.
And your sister, Jemima Kirk, correct, was in the show Girls and a bunch of other stuff.
Yeah.
So has it been great growing up in that sort of environment, like,
I mean,
inspiring in any way?
Absolutely, or inspiring in both negative and positive ways.
Yeah.
but I'm very grateful for how I grew up. I love my family so much, and they're a colorful bunch.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
So your music has a country feel to it, but maybe not the typical, quote, country music people might assume or hear on the radio today. So did you grow up with classic country albums around? What sounds do you tap into or do you go to inspire your music?
Well, as Trapper mentioned, my dad was in classic rock groups, so I grew up listening to a lot of that. We had moved from England to New York when I was 4, so I kind of was always fascinated by America because I was living in America. It was this new place. So I started listening to a lot more American rock and roll, Laurel Canyon stuff. And then that was my foray into the Byrds, which kind of led me to Gram Parsons. And then through Gram Parsons, I got into a lot of more classic country. And now I feel like I'm listening to very contemporary country. My last record, Lady for Sale, which came out on Third Man in 2022, was like an 80s country inspired record. I never thought that I would be listening to that music. I didn't grow up listening to country radio. So it wasn't necessarily nostalgic for me, but then I just started listening to a lot of 80s and 90s country.
I hear some like Shania in there.
Oh,
like,
yeah. Well, she crossed over. Faith Hill and Shania Twain and Garth Brooks, or Chris Gaines, as I like to say, really crossed over into the radio stations I was listening to when I was younger.
Yeah. Well, I grew up in the country, and my bus driver, I lived like at the end of a bus route. And so I was the last kid off the bus, and he blared like 90s country, like Randy Jackson, Garth, all the classic storytellers, you know.
Yes.
And that's ultimately what I feel is sort of missing from some of the contemporary, you know, big country music of today. But thank you, Lola,
for bringing your
Trapper. Yeah, just one more question.
Yeah.
No, it's not on this one. It's just coming to mind. But so the sound is one thing, but I also want to talk about your costumes. Because just like acting, you have a whole costume for your performing.
Yes.
So do these boots have a name? I know you like to name your boots.
These boots, they're from this company called Fraulein. I actually copied Margot Price because she had this pair. And when I was in her wardrobe with her, I was like, I was stunned by their beauty. For those who cannot see these boots, because you're listening,
you'll have
to the
radio, see the video.
They are like
these
the
boots.
Most gorgeous. The color, I've never even seen a color this gorgeous. And then this suit that I'm wearing right now is actually made to look like. Am I allowed to say a part of the female anatomy on the radio?
Absolutely.
It's based on a vulva.
Beautiful. Love it.
And I just was taken by it. But yes, I love wearing pink and glitter and all sorts of feminine things, and it really helps me kind of shift from, you know, who I am personally into who I want to be on stage.
Well, thank you for sharing who you want to be on stage with us today at the Surf Shop.
Thank you so much, guys.
Thank you, Lola. This
thank
is great.
You.
That was Lola Kirk joining us for Live at Lake Effect, accompanied by Josh Kaler on the pedal steel and electric guitar. Her latest album, Trailblazer, is out now. Be sure to head to WUWM.com or our YouTube page to see Lola Kirk performing three original songs in the Lake Effect Surf Shop. Milwaukee musician Trapper Shep and myself are the executive producers of Live at Lake Effect. Sound engineering is done by WUWM's Jason Reavy, and thanks to our friends at Visionary Studios, a local advertising agency, for filming and editing this episode. WUWM's YouTube page has our past episodes of Live at Lake Effect featuring Craig Finn, David Shaw, Sullis, Buffalo Nichols, and many more. All my exes live in L.A. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take us on the go, simply download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll hear from outgoing UW-Milwaukee Chancellor Mark Mone about the challenges and successes of his time in the role. Thank you so much for joining us on Lake Effect today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. So sweet. Them hips been good to me, but it's time to say goodbye.